Welcome to the third event of the Leon Panetta 2014 Lecture Series here in beautiful Monterey at the Monterey Conference Center. The theme of our series has us looking at the 100 years since World War I and the changes that have taken place during those years. During the first two lectures, we discussed war and peace, and we also discussed the role of government. Tonight, we focus on the balance between protecting our country and protecting our freedoms. Our Constitution in the Bill of Rights makes clear the fundamental freedoms that we cherish in America. But it also defines the responsibility of providing for our common defense. Do we have to choose between our freedom and our security? Benjamin Franklin spoke to this essential debate in a letter he wrote in 1755. In it he said, quote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety," unquote. Franklin understood that liberty was the most precious element in the new democracy that he and his colleagues were forming, which was the United States. However, liberty can't flourish without security. More than 250 years later, we're still grappling to balance these critical objectives. How can we keep our nation safe while preserving the liberty that we hold so dear? It's a question that becomes a particularly vital question when our nation goes to war. From the Alien and Sedition Act signed by President John Adams, to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, to the current debate over the scope and oversight of surveillance after the attack on 9/11, our nation has struggled with the balance between safety and between liberty. Liberty has often paid the price. Today, the largest threat to our security is terrorism. And our strongest weapon against another terrorist attack is good intelligence. But how do we get that intelligence without risking personal freedoms and privacy? Can a democracy provide the checks and balances necessary to allow us to be both safe and free at the same time? Can we do both? And if not, what are we willing to sacrifice? We'll pose these questions to three individuals who are experts on the one international and domestic threats that we face, two, the efforts we have made to protect ourselves, and three, the complicated debate over the use of new technologies and surveillance. Our first guest is a celebrated author and journalist and a fellow at the Century Foundation. He was the lead reporter of the Washington Post's series of articles on classified documents released by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. His coverage of Snowden's revelations about the scope of the NSA's electronic surveillance triggered a global debate, as well as a major review by the Obama administration, as well as the Congress. With more than 25 years' experience reporting on legal studies, on the military, on diplomacy, on the Pentagon in the Middle East, he was recently awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting of the Snowden scandal. Please welcome Barton Gellman. Welcome. Our second guest is the former acting director and former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency and is one of the country's most prominent national security professionals with extensive experience in intelligence and foreign policy. He has served as the CIA's top analyst. He's represented the agency at the White House and in Congress, and he has maintained the agency's relationships with intelligence services and foreign leaders around the world. He was deputy director when Leon was the director of the CIA, and he worked closely with Leon on the successful operation to bring Osama bin Laden to justice. Please welcome Mike Morrell. third guest is a decorated war veteran who was awarded the Bronze Star, 2 Navy Commendation Medals, and the Purple Heart. He followed his military service with work as a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office before being named the 6th director of the FBI. He took office 1 week before 9/11 terrorist attacks. Imagine 1 week. He is the longest serving director since J. Edgar Hoover and is credited with reshaping the Bureau from a traditional law enforcement agency to a threat-focused, intelligence-based national security organization. He worked closely with Leon to improve the intelligence relationship between the FBI and the CIA. Please welcome Robert Mueller. Moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 17 years ago, as you know, the chairman of the Panetta Institute. From both his time as director of the CIA and as Secretary of Defense, he knows very well how difficult it is to find the line between protecting our country and protecting our freedoms. Please welcome Secretary Leon Panetta.
Welcome. Welcome. Welcome to our third forum in our lecture series. As you know, the theme is looking at 100 years, 2014, 1914, since World War I, and the changes that have taken place. We've talked about issues of war and peace. We looked at the issue of the role of government and how that's changed. And tonight we talk about this very critical issue of our freedom versus our security. Our Constitution provides protection for both our freedoms and for our country. And the Bill of Rights lays out our freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of petition, freedom of assembly, etc. And our Constitution also talks about the need for a common defense. Actually, it was Jefferson, interesting quote from Jefferson, who said that the responsibility of a president, even though, you know, we understand what the Constitution's about, but that there's a higher law here, which is the responsibility to protect a nation is of the highest responsibility. This is the guy who authored the Declaration of Independence, and at the same time felt very deeply about the need to protect the United States. So it's that kind of tension that we're going to talk about tonight. Obviously, the tension appears the most when we're in crisis, when we're in war. Alien Sedition Act was passed. First one was passed by John Adams, worried about war with Great Britain. President Wilson passed an Alien and Sedition Act in World War I, prohibiting people from criticizing the government. Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, worried about making sure that those who were pro the Confederacy were detained, even without due process. And of course, the example that a lot of us are familiar with from 1942, after Pearl Harbor, when President Roosevelt, by executive order, took almost 100,000 Japanese and put them in internment camps. And then after 9/11, we had the Patriot Act and the authority to provide greater surveillance in order to make sure we had the intelligence to go after terrorists. So you can see throughout history, the tension that we've seen. And I guess the first question I would ask our distinguished panel here is, do we have to choose between freedom and our security? Some have said, if you choose one, you're going to sacrifice the other. But can we have both in our democratic society? Bob?
Well, I think you can. Indeed, you have to have both. There are going to be trade-offs you make for security as well as for assuring our civil liberties. But you, day in and day out, you have to try to make that balance. There was no doubt in the wake of September 11th, as we looked at what had to be done, that history would look back and look upon what we did and would judge us not only on whether we protected the nation from another terrorist attack, but also whether we did so consistent with the civil liberties that are established in the Constitution, the applicable statutes, and as well in our FBI guidelines. So from the outset, we understood that there is going to be a balance. Much of it is made by Congress in the form of legislation. But day in and day out, in the course of investigating individuals, you have that balance on an individual investigative level as well as on looking at it from the perspective of the country as a whole.
Mike?
I agree with Bob. The only thing I would add is that this is becoming a much more important issue as we go forward here, because the nation has never faced the national security threats that it's facing today. Most important, international terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, cyber, very significant threats facing us. And at the same time, technology gives the government tremendous power to collect intelligence. So great threats, great power to collect intelligence. This is a fundamentally important issue, and it's going to become even more important as we move forward.
Bart?
Well, you quoted Thomas Jefferson, and one of the great things about Jefferson, he was so brilliant and prolific that you could find something to support whatever. the quote we're fond of in my newsroom is that he'd rather have, if he was forced to choose, he'd rather have newspapers without government than government without newspapers. Just a coincidence. You also pointed out the Japanese internment. So we, you know, in times of war, in times of fear, in times of threat, there are times when the government or when the society as a whole reacts so strongly that it later comes to believe that it went too far. In the case of the Japanese internment, it took decades before the United States government and the United States people decided that that had been the wrong thing to do. Woodrow Wilson, who passed the Espionage Act of 1917, used it first to prosecute the socialist candidate for president, Eugene Debs, for opposing entry into the war. That is also not seen now as its finest moment. The difference between those things and what we're seeing today is that those things took place in the open. So they were susceptible to debate. You could say, was that a good idea or not, to round up all the Japanese citizens of the United States? And you could debate it. And right now what we're having is we're having the government accumulating or asserting extraordinary powers largely in secret. In which sort of very large policy decisions about where to draw the boundaries between secret intelligence and democratic self-government are taking place in a way that is not accessible to the public. And obviously, lots of things in the intelligence world have to be not accessible to the public. But the big policy decisions, the big line-drawing exercise, does need, I would argue, to be done more in public so that you and all of us collectively can make the decisions you're asking about.
Okay, the way our Constitution is structured, it tries to provide protection so that we can have both freedom and security, but it does it through a system of checks and balances in our three separate but equal branches of government. What are those checks and balances? I mean, to some extent, the reason that the revelations came from Snowden, in part in an article he wrote, was that Snowden found that checks and balances were kind of a graveyard of judgment in terms of the oversight that was conducted. But what are the checks and balances that we have, and how effectively do they work? Mike, start with you.
So the key program at issue here is the so-called 215 telephone metadata program, Section 215 of the Patriot Act, under which NSA was bringing telephone metadata of phone calls made by Americans to Americans, putting it in a database and being able to query it when it was looking for terrorism information. when it had a reasonable suspicion of terrorism activity, that it could query the database. That's the main program at issue here. And that program was under more scrutiny than any other program in the executive branch, and under more scrutiny than any program that I've been involved with during my 33 years in the intelligence business. It was under scrutiny and oversight at the National Security Agency in terms of the number of people who had the ability to query, what they had to do in order to carry out a query, the extent to which they were overseen by their own agency and by the Inspector General of their own agency, the extent to which they were overseen by the rest of the executive branch, including the Department of Justice, the great extent to which they were overseen by the two intelligence committees in Congress, and unusual for an intelligence program, the extent to which they were overseen by a special court, the FISA court. And so there was more oversight of this particular program than anything I can remember.
Bob?
Well, a couple of things about that program. First, it is important to recognize that it was established to fill a gap that the 9/11 Commission found was present prior to September 11th, where you had a telephone number associated with terrorists in another country, but you don't know who in the United States may be contacting that number. And so the 9/11 Commission says fill that gap, and this program was established in part to fill that gap. Perhaps a second, in terms of oversight, what is generally not out there in the public is that we in the United States are unique in the sense that we have a specialized court, a third branch of government, that reviews the applications for the court orders that establish the program. No other country that I'm aware of has a court to whom or to which you have to make application to undertake this kind of activity. And I am very comfortable, generally, when a court is in charge of assuring that legal standards are met and that somebody other than the executive is looking at and judging the particular instance in which you're seeking that court order. So I think that level of oversight is tremendously important, but it's also unique to the United States, and that perhaps has not been out there as well.
Mark, checks and balances.
Well, I would disagree that the call records program, the so-called Section 215 program, which was a provision of the Patriot Act, is the sort of the central program at issue. It's certainly been talked about a lot. That is the one that has the most supervision. The great majority of what the NSA does, including the great majority of what it does that affects U.S. persons, that affects American data, happens overseas, where the court does not have jurisdiction and is not involved in any way. It is also the case that the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman, senator from this state, said that the committee itself, that Congress does not oversee overseas operations anything like the level of attention that it does to operations that take place in the United States. It's also the case that checks and balances are not just among the three branches of government. It's not just the sort of high school lesson you learn in civics about the balance among the branches of government. Checks and balances include a huge swath of civil society. We have evolved as a democracy in our self-government in a way that public debate and lobbying and lawsuits and actions by private actors in the private sector have a great deal of influence over the direction of policy. We've been unable to have that debate because of secrecy. And I'll give just one quick example before I yield the floor here. Section 215 was not an obscure provision. It was hotly debated when the Patriot Act was authorized and when it was reauthorized. It's the business records provision, and there was a great deal of controversy over the degree of the scope of government activity that it seemed to permit. The U.S. government not only never disclosed that it was interpreting that to mean that it was entitled to get a record of every single phone call that all of you made, you know, who you called, when you called them, how long you talked. Not only didn't disclose that, but when it put out official statistics, it said, don't worry about this provision. We've only used it 21 times in all of 2009. Well, when 12 of those 21 were sufficient to get 1 trillion call records, that is at best misleading. And it suppresses the kind of debate over where we want to draw the lines that I think the public's entitled to have.
Well, you know, let's talk about the issue of right of privacy, particularly in today's world. I mean, look, kids are on Twitter, they're on Facebook, they're providing their whole life on these computers and these various blogs that are out there. Microsoft, Yahoo, Google are collecting tremendous amounts of information. I mean, we go to a grocery store, they find out everything we're doing in terms of shopping. GPS follows us everywhere. We also have banking. You know, people follow your banking records. I mean, the reality is there is a huge amount of information that's collected, not by the government, but by the private sector. And if there's a likelihood of abuse by the government, is there not a likelihood of abuse by the private sector? Is there really today a right of privacy anymore?
I think there certainly is a right to privacy. It's a question of definition. What is privacy? And the Supreme Court has been a little bit over, it doesn't say anything specifically in the Constitution, so there are interpretations of it. I mean, what I do think is that the definition of privacy is going to be changing over a period of time. And you have to look at specific instances where information is being collected, disseminated, or collected and used, and adjust and adapt as standards to this new technological world. And you should. I mean, we should. But it's very difficult, I think, at this juncture to come up with one definition of that right to privacy.
I think I take this in a little bit different direction. My job was to collect intelligence to keep the country safe. You know, and at the end of the day, that was the job. That was your job when you were my boss. And he made it my job.
I said, you do it.
And what we need to know as intelligence officers is, where are the lines? Where are the lines in terms of what we can do and what can't we do? And those lines can't move on us every day. They can't change every day. They can certainly change over a period of time, but they can't change every day. And most important, you can't change the line retrospectively, right? You can't say, we're going to change the line today, and everything you did for the last 10 years, somehow you were in the wrong, somehow you were breaking the law. That is not a place I want my officers to be. So in terms of privacy, define where you want it, tell me what I'm allowed to do, and let me do my job, and don't come back 10 years later and tell me that I've done something I shouldn't have done.
Bart, right of privacy?
So whenever I talk to folks from these agencies here or the NSA or the White House, they say, well, what about Google? What about Facebook? Why aren't you chasing after them for all these invasions of privacy? And my view is, why choose? I think that there's a continuum of significant privacy issues. And the law is not clear. The culture is not clear. But a lot of very powerful interests who are making tens and hundreds of billions of dollars off the information economy, and these guys who would like to piggyback on that from time to time because there's a lot of valuable information in there for intelligence purposes.
With court orders.
Or without. I will try to demonstrate this. Okay, if you want to get the information from Google in this country, you have a court order. But if the NSA wants to get the information overseas, it is not restricted by FISA or its amendments. It is not overseen by the court. And what it does is, there's a Google data center here in Ireland, and there's one here in Hong Kong, and there's a private cable it's a privately leased link that goes between them. The NSA finds a spot on that cable and helps itself. And there, it is doing so overseas. It is lawful under current law for it to do that, although it's actually debatable. I know that there are a couple of companies in the Valley who are thinking that that represents targeting of a U.S. person, because the companies are defined as U.S. persons in the law. But I'm sure that they are legitimately looking for foreign intelligence in this, but they are sweeping in hundreds of billions of communications that belong to U.S. persons as well as to foreign people. No court is supervising that. So the question is, where do we want to draw the lines? And again, I think that what's been happening in the past year is we've had greater transparency, which has enabled Congress and courts and public opinion and private industry to not only to debate, but to take actions that are going to redefine the balance. And if the courts and the Congress were so set on this, if the oversight was working so well, why is it that the first two federal courts to look at this outside the secret FISA system are split? One of the district judges has said that this telephone records program is actually likely unconstitutional.
And the next one said?
And the next one said it's perfectly constitutional and it's likely to get to the Supreme Court. But if you have a controversy that is splitting the federal courts, there's a meaningful debate going on there. And Congress came within, you know, 8 votes of abolishing the program.
Let me get back. I think the concern is this huge breadth of information that the government could have access to, and at least, even though there's no evidence of abuse, the potential for abuse, that somehow the government could find out, you know, something that has nothing to do with terrorism, and that would be the abuse that's concerned about. But if the private sector is collecting that much information, why isn't there the potential for abuse by the private sector?
I think there is. I mean, there's a huge potential for abuse by the private sector. We haven't yet defined abuse, but what's clear is that the private sector has done its very best to make completely opaque to us what it does with our data. I hired a guy because I'm interested in surveillance and big data issues. I hired someone to essentially to break into my connection of my iPad to the outside world. It's called a man-in-the-middle attack. And he was thereby able to spy on the people spying on me as I sort of used the iPad. He could see what there's no way any of you or I could do on our own. So I've already taken a little guff about this in the back room, but I loaded up various apps to kind of just see what the privacy implications were. And I put in a medical app, and I searched for syphilis. Okay, this is a hypothetical
syphilis.
This is a family
audience.
That we're talking about here.
A number of other words in that dictionary.
I could have searched for moral rectitude and all, but I went for syphilis. And what you see on the screen is this sort of blossom with me in the center, and a pictogram of with names of all the connections that are opened up to my iPad the second I hit the I tapped the button to companies I had never heard of or some that I had heard of, and we watched the data go out, and it's got my zip code, it's got my gender, it's got unique device identifier, it's got the word syphilis some of the time, and this is all being done in a way that you can't possibly know, even if you're the one in a million who reads through all the terms of service.
This whole debate obviously came out of 9/11, and I'd like to, at least for a moment, have each of you kind of talk about where you were, because there are some interesting stories here in your backgrounds. I mean, Mike was the intelligence briefer for the President of the United States. The briefer is the person who briefs the President on the intelligence reports every day and goes with the President wherever the President goes, and Mike played that role. Bob Mueller just became FBI director, and a few days later, 9/11 happened. And Bart was actually in New York at the time and went down to where the Trade Center was at that point in time. So if you could talk a little bit about you know, that day and where you were at. Mike, let's start with you.
I was President Bush's intelligence briefer from January 4th, 2001 to January 4th, 2002. Who's counting? I saw him 6 days a week, no matter where he was, whether it was at the White House, whether it was Camp David, whether it was his ranch in Crawford, whether he was traveling overseas or traveling domestically. So I was on the plane. I was on Air Force One when it went wheels up on September 10th to go to first to Jacksonville and then to Sarasota for the president to do a couple of events around his new education policy. My job was to brief him on Tuesday morning, give him his, the president's daily brief on Tuesday morning, which I did from 8 to 8:30. And then we all climbed into the motorcade and drove to the school, Booker T. Elementary School. And it was on the way that the first plane hit, about 8:45 a.m. And it was just after the president went into the classroom with the kids and started listening to the story about the pet goat that the rest of us in the adjacent room saw the second plane hit, at which point there was no doubt that this was terrorism. I spent the rest of the day with the president, flying with him to Barksdale Air Force Base, to Offutt Air Force Base, to and then back to Andrews. And for me, it was a kind of a day of a mixed day of doing my job and the surreal. A couple of examples of me doing my job. On the flight from Barksdale to Offutt, the president asked to see me alone, so only Andy Card joined us. And the president said to me, "Michael, who did this?" And I said, "Mr. President, I haven't seen any intelligence as to indicate who did this, but, you know, I'll certainly speculate." And he said, "I understand, get on with it." And I said, "Look, there's a couple of countries who have the capability of doing this, Iran and Iraq, but they have nothing to gain and everything to lose by doing something like this. There's no doubt in my mind that the trail will end with al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden." I actually told him that I would bet my children's future on that. I've never told my kids that, so I hope they don't watch this program. And then he said to me, "When will we know?" And so I reached back into my memory and described for him how long it took us to know for sure who the culprits were in the Khobar bombings attacks, the East Africa embassy attacks, and the coal attack, and it was different in each case. And so I said, "Mr. President, it may be soon, it may be a while before we know." That was an example of me doing my job that day. An example of the surreal was on final approach that night to Andrews, we were landing from west to east, and as you looked out the left side of the aircraft, you could see an F-16 on the wing. The F-16 was so close, you could see the pilot's face looking at us. And in the distance, you could see the still-burning Pentagon, flames and smoke. So that was kind of the day for me. I'll never forget a single detail of it.
Bob? I'm not certain I remember all of it, thank you. But I just started in the Bureau the week before and was getting briefed on another terrorist case when an agent came into the conference room and said there's a plane that went into one of the towers in New York. You look outside, beautiful day. What's it like in New York? Beautiful day, and you can't comprehend how this could happen. Then the second plane hit. And by that time, we figured it was probably a terrorist attack. And when the plane hit the Pentagon, we were also, along with Mike's people, firmly of the belief that it was probably that it was bin Laden. We then went to a command center downstairs, and we had a feed in from the FAA and Aviation Administration. And the voice would say, "Hijacked plane inbound to Washington, D.C., 90 miles out." Then a few moments later, "Hijacked plane inbound to D.C., 80 miles out." And so you sit there understanding that there's a hijacked plane and you don't know whether the target's going to be the Capitol or the White House. But ultimately, as everyone knows, that's a plane that went down in Pennsylvania, but it's one of the lasting impressions I have. I believe that the president called early in the afternoon. That was affirmed by Mike here, who remembers that call, because some of it is a blur, and basically said, we've got to get these individuals. Perhaps more important and significant was a briefing I had of President Bush two or three days later, in which I go into the and start the briefing in the Oval Office with the President, Vice President, George Tenet, and others. And I started up briefing about saying, well, we've got command centers at the Pentagon and up in New York. We've started to identify the individuals who are responsible. And as I remember it, the President says, stop a second, Bob. He says, what you're telling me you're doing is what the FBI has done and done pretty well over the years of its existence. My question to you is, what is the FBI doing to prevent the next terrorist attack? Now, I was a prosecutor and in an FBI investigative agency, and for most of our history, we have been investigators of incidents after they have occurred. The question that was being asked to me that day was to determine what is and could be anticipated and utilize the FBI for these purposes. And it was a question that was asked every day as I briefed the President, along with Mike thereafter, first term, second term, and by President Obama. The question of the Bureau is, what are you doing to prevent the next terrorist attack? And out of that flowed a number of changes in the Bureau. And in terms of significance to the history of the Bureau, it's not necessarily the attack that was the catalyst, but it was a question that has perpetually been asked by each president after that. What is the FBI doing to prevent the next terrorist attack?
Bart?
After that, I don't know what I should, how I should follow that. I got the same phone call a lot of you probably got. Turn on the TV. I live in New York. I immediately, because reporters and photographers are not normal people, headed down toward the scene when a lot of New York City was flowing away from it. I had a really hard time getting any, I didn't want to get on a subway. I'd never get in a metal box that closes. If you're intent on getting somewhere, I figured it would, the trains would stop. So I had to flag down a car. Nobody wanted to drive downtown. So I just sort of took out all the cash I had in my wallet, started waving it in the faces of taxi drivers. Got one to get me down, pretty far down towards the scene. Then he wouldn't go any further, and I flagged down a motorcycle, a great big guy with a belly and a beard. And he was a tourist, and he wanted to go take a picture with his disposable camera. I held out my press card as though it actually meant anything, and told this guy about 6'8" that he needed to drive me down there too, and he fell for it. And I got as close as I could, closer than was probably prudent, and was there in time to see and hear and feel the second tower go down. And it, what you don't get on TV is the visceral sort of shaking of the air, the sort of vibration that seemed to go on and on and on. And I was so stunned that even though I knew I was a reporter and I had a notebook and was supposed to be taking notes, I couldn't think of anything to write except gone. I still have that notebook. I wrote gone, and then a minute later I looked down and I saw there was no other notes, so I just underlined it. But I didn't have words then. And I've known people who were much more personally affected than I was. By the events of that day, I've interviewed lots of others, and it definitely sets my appreciation for the gravity of the issues we're dealing with when we talk about balancing national security with self-government.
We're, you know, obviously the 9/11 Commission looked at it because the question at the time was, how the hell could this happen? Why did we not take steps to prevent it? And termination by the 9/11 Commission was essentially that intelligence had failed. We didn't have the intelligence. Whatever intelligence we had was not being shared. They pointed out a lot of problems. And during the interim, obviously, we've taken a lot of steps to try to improve our intelligence, improve the sharing. Intelligence is, in many ways, the key to trying to prevent that attack in the future. Getting information about what the terrorists are doing, what they're planning, et cetera. And we've done a lot of that. I guess You know, my question would be, and it's in the context, obviously, of having collected a lot of intelligence that in some ways helped us. How confident are you that, you know, the intelligence we've developed and the sharing that's going on has helped prevent another 9/11?
Well, I'm very confident that it has. We've had a number of attacks that have been disrupted over both domestically and overseas. It has been one of the things we did not have before September 11th is a sharing of information between the intelligence agencies who operate overseas, NSA, DOD, CIA, and the FBI. That was rectified very shortly after September 11th. And part of it statutory, breaking down the walls that had been in existence beforehand in the sharing of that intelligence. As important was breaking down the people barriers, the cultures of the two three institutions who were involved, where intelligence did not share with law enforcement, and law enforcement did not share with intelligence. And it was personal relationships and understanding that in the wake of September 11th, that if we were to protect the country, we had to integrate intelligence developed overseas with intelligence developed domestically, because here we had had an attack that was contemplated, organized, and put into place overseas with the impact domestically. That was one of the first ones since Pearl Harbor. And that we all had to operate differently, and we had to integrate that intelligence. And I think we did, a pretty good job. Every time I say that, I think of Major Hassan and the 13 persons who were killed in Fort Hood. Every time I say that, I think of the Boston Marathon bombing, where the individuals who lost their lives there. And so while, yes, we have been successful, and yes, there has not been a large-scale attack from overseas, that does not mean that we have not lost persons to terrorism in the intervening years.
Michael?
I would just say that just to give you a sense of how important intelligence is to draw a contrast with the Cold War. During the Cold War, the enemy was very easy to find, but very hard to kill. The enemy was Soviet tank divisions in Eastern Europe. Very easy to find them because you could see them with aerial photography. Very difficult to do anything about. Terrorism is just the opposite. The enemy is very easy to kill, but very, very hard to find. And it's that very, very hard to find that puts the emphasis on intelligence, because intelligence is all about the finding.
Court, comments?
I think it's self-evident that intelligence is vital in any conflict, and there's a lot of obvious truths. The idea that you have a more elusive target that could do real damage. There's another set of contrasts to the Cold War, in which we had a genuinely existential threat that we grew up knowing could come close to an extinction event for humankind on Earth. And it is possible to overestimate the intensity of the threat from terrorism. That's not to make light of it at all. As I said, I have a very strong appreciation for what it can do and what it feels like and what it means. The question always is, how far are we willing to go in order to prevent it? So in order to prevent the Boston bombing, there was a tip to the FBI that the elder Tsarnaev brother might have been a bad guy. The Russians sent that along to the U.S. government. The U.S. government could have done what the Russians probably would have done, which is just stick him in jail or shoot him in the head. Threatened over. Don't have to worry about it. Probably would have averted the bombing. But we don't work that way. We don't. If a wallet goes missing in here, we don't turn all your pockets inside out and do cavity searches. That's by far the most efficient way to find out who took the wallet. It's almost 100% guaranteed to work. But we don't do it that way. We had a revolution in this country against the idea of general warrants imposed by the British. So the question is always, what are we willing to trade off? And I don't have the answers to all that. What I do believe is that some of the most fundamental questions need to be subjected to full public scrutiny.
Let me just add to that.
Go ahead.
The balance. The Boston Marathon and actually Fort Hood are an example of how, through our legislative efforts, you balance it. In both those cases, we had individuals who were the persons responsible. And in another country, they would have put a wire on them. In other words, intercepted the conversations probably early on and for an extended period. We cannot do that without probable cause. And in both cases, the issue of probable cause was discussed, but I believe that we'd had insufficient probable cause to take that step. That is a balance that Congress has made in terms of what we have to show in order to intercept conversations, and it's something that we're comfortable with. But the question will always be asked by those who are looking at what you did not do is, would that have prevented the loss of these lives?
Let me, we're at the break here, but Mike, I just want to ask you, what is the nature of the threat from Al-Qaeda? We've pretty much done a pretty good job at going after core Al-Qaeda leadership in Pakistan, with the bin Laden raid and going after some of their core leaders. But if you look at Al-Qaeda today, give me kind of an intelligence analysis as to what is the nature of the threat.
So we are still at war. We are still at war with this entity that we've been at war with for 16 years now. They still want to kill Americans. They still want to kill people in this room simply because you're Americans. And in that war, we have had a great victory, but so have they. Our great victory in that war is the one you described, the degradation, decimation, near defeat of Al-Qaeda in the tribal areas of Pakistan, the Al-Qaeda leadership, the Al-Qaeda guys who brought us that terror on that beautiful, sunny September day. That's our great victory. Their great victory in this war has been the spread of their ideology, the spread of their franchise over a huge geographic area that now runs from northern Nigeria into the Sahel, which is Mali and the countries around it, across all of North Africa, from Morocco to Algeria to Tunisia to Libya to Egypt. Al-Qaeda was gone from Egypt for 2 decades, and it is now back. Down into East Africa, in Somalia, and increasingly in Kenya, across the Gulf across the waters into Yemen, up now in Iraq and Syria. There are now more Al-Qaeda operatives in Syria than in the rest of the world combined. Best way to describe the threat to us from what I just said is the threat to the homeland has been reduced because of that undermining of core Al-Qaeda. It was true right before 9/11 and then in the 2006 to 2008 period that Al-Qaeda was capable of conducting multiple simultaneous catastrophic attacks that killed thousands. They no longer are capable of doing that. They are, Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Al-Qaeda in Yemen are both capable of conducting single attacks here in the States that kill hundreds. If Al-Qaeda in Yemen brought down an airliner in the United States tomorrow, I would not be surprised. Al-Qaeda in Yemen is responsible for the last 3 attempted attacks against this country. The Christmas Day bomber, the printer cartridge plot to bring down cargo planes, and the non-metallic suicide vest designed to bring down an aircraft. All 3 of those came out of Yemen. So I would not be surprised. So threat to the homeland reduced but still exists in a very serious way. And because of what's happening in Syria and because of what is likely to happen in the future of Afghanistan, I'm concerned that threat to the homeland is going to go back up. At the same time, you have an increased threat to Americans, American entities, and American interests across that whole geographic area that I talked about. So it's the Nairobi Mall kind of threat. It's the Benghazi kind of threat. It's the In Amenas in Algeria kind of threat. And in two of those attacks, Americans died. So that's kind of how I think about the threat today.
Okay, on that happy note, let me move on here to...
Sorry.
what I'd like to do is to take a moment to recognize the question review team that reviews the questions, selects the questions that I'll present to the speakers. And if you'll hold your applause, let me just introduce them. Julie Copeland, who's city editor from the Santa Cruz Sentinel, Allison Gatlin, who's a reporter, Salinas, Californian, Fran Gaver, who's an attorney with Leach & Walker and also a veteran review team member, Doug McKnight, reporter for KAZU Radio, Philip Molnar, who's a reporter for the Monterey Herald, and Teresa Wright, who is the public affairs manager for KSBW. If you would give them a hand, I'd appreciate it. At this time, I'd like all the students in the audience, if they would stand, please. Students, stand up. All right. These students were part of the program this afternoon, and they come from the following: Cal State Monterey Bay, Defense Language Institute, the Monterey County Home Charter School, Monterey High Postgraduate School, the Navy Postgraduate School, Pacific Grove High, San Jose State University, Santa Clara University, the University of California at Santa Cruz. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it very much. And lastly, if you would please acknowledge the sponsors that make that student program possible. We had almost 400 students at the session this afternoon, and believe me, I think it was really interesting. They asked a lot of interesting questions, but it is their generation that is going to have to deal with this whole issue of how technology is rapidly expanding and how we balance this issue of privacy versus our need to secure this country. They're the ones that are going to have to deal with it.